Hey, everyone. Brittany Lynch here. Today, I have a really exciting interview lined up for you on how to achieve financial independence. Our guest is Justin McCurry, and Justin is now retired and runs the personal finance blog rootofgood.com. He managed to retire at the age of 33 after working for just 10 years, which I think is pretty damn incredible. So, there are a number of topics I'm looking forward to speaking with Justin about, from the specifics of his early retirement plan, his asset allocation and investment strategies, and hearing exactly how he managed to pay only $150 tax on a combined income of $150,000 in 1 year. I know that's something I'd definitely like to learn more about. So, with that said, Justin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks a lot, Brittany.
Awesome. So, why don't we just start out by telling myself and our listeners what exactly financial independence is for those who aren't familiar with it, and what that concept meant and what it meant for you reaching financial independence at just 33?
Okay, sure. Financial independence, in a nutshell, it's a pretty broad term. So I'll kind of jump into, in general, in the, in the personal finance world, it's basically being able to support yourself and your living expenses using some kind of a passive income stream. And that can be real estate, businesses that run themselves, and for me, it really means an investment portfolio, stocks, bonds, that sort of thing. So it's really just when you have financial independence, when you get to the point where all of your investments generate enough income to be able to support yourself indefinitely.
Okay, great. And was that always your goal when you started working? Did you set out thinking, I really want to retire in 10 years? Or was that something that kind of came as you started putting your plan into place?
Right. It was originally when I started working, I just realized, whoa, I've got this paycheck that's bigger than what I'm spending. So what am I going to do with it? Well, I'm just going to save it. So I just started out saving money, just like lots of people do, 401k. I even had some extra money left over at the end of each month. So I started a brokerage account, put some money in there, and didn't really know too much about investing or early retirement, financial independence, none of that really starting out. Then I started digging into it and researching online, and I found there's, a whole community of people out there on the internet that are aiming for financial independence. And so that once I learned about that and kind of figured out what it takes, kind of the building blocks to have your own financial independence plan, what does that mean? That's when I started crystallizing in my own mind how I was going to reach financial independence. Came up with what I'm going to have to save, that sort of idea of it. And it started out really as well, I'm just going to keep working as long as I need to until I have enough money to be able to retire early. So it was it, and it ended up I ended up needing a lot less than I thought I would initially. But you start out thinking one thing, and then as you get closer to your goal, you refine that goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I thought was interesting that you just said was you didn't really know too much about the concept of financial independence or exactly how to achieve it before the start of this 10-year period. And that kind of surprised me because I read in your blog post you graduated out of college without any debt, and it seemed like you kind of showed good financial discipline earlier on in your life. Is that true, or you think you got a lot better in the last 10 years?
I just want to correct. We actually had debt coming out of graduate school, but we turned some of the loans that we got for student loans. We turned some of those into assets while we were in school, and we worked some too. So we started out of school with about a zero net worth, but we did have some loans. And it was, I mean, we worked, even from high school. I mean, I had the concept of building wealth and having being comfortable in terms of, having some cash in the bank, that sort of thing. I had that concept in mind even in middle school and high school. I mean, so I certainly started making the right financial decisions very early on. I mean, I know a lot of people kind of graduate and college in their 20s and end up, deep in debt, and so they're really digging themselves out of a hole in their 20s instead of, for me, I was 23, graduated from graduate school, and kind of started at a zero point in my own life, and not really deep in debt. I mean, zero net worth, I should say. I had debt, but I had assets.
Okay, so you graduated from school, and then at that point, you start working your first job, and your high-level approach to financial independence at that point was you're putting money aside for savings. And then can you walk me through just the high level of what your approach was at that point?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started out really just dumping money into some, I can't remember the investment. I think it was like a some mutual fund. I was just dumping money in there because I didn't really know anything better, but I knew stocks grow over the long term. Stocks tend to grow really well, so I'm just going to dump my money into stocks, and you know, in 20 years or whatever, I'll have a bunch more money. That was kind of my the way I invested the first year and a half. And eventually I started reading more about asset allocation and expenses and sort of the how the stock market works in terms of if you're paying more in expenses and you're paying for a really expensive mutual fund or a money manager, all those expenses tend to come right out of your portfolio. I mean, you're paying them, so there's not any magic by hiring an advisor. So I really at that point said, well, I can save myself a lot of money over the long term by figuring out this whole investing thing myself, instead of paying an advisor 1 or 2% of my assets each year. I can just do this on my own. I mean, I can read books, I can go online, look at other resources. So that was sort of that first step that got me in the mindset of investing on my own, was just, you know, doing the hard work of researching and learning how the market works, how my own investments, finding a good low cost investment option, which I use Vanguard. I'm a personal fan of Vanguard.
Yeah, and I think that what you said, a lot of people don't realize that 1 or 2% to pay someone to manage your money really adds up over time. I mean, that could mean hundreds of thousands of dollars in the fullness of your lifetime.
Absolutely, and it's really, you know, you're talking about now. I mean, I've seen people saying we're going to have 4% or 6% stock market returns for 10 years. Historically, it's been more 7 to 9%. So yeah, giving up 1 or 2% per year in different kinds of fees is like giving up a quarter or a third of all your return.
Yeah.
And you know, I worked hard enough for my money. I didn't want to give up between a third and a quarter of what I'm earning each year on my own assets, you know. So when you look at it that way, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to spend the time to learn how to manage your own money. And it's not that hard either. I mean, doesn't have to be that complicated.
Right, yeah. So this is a really good piece of advice for anyone who's just starting out is keep cost in mind of what the cost is for your investments. And that's something we'll probably touch on a little bit later in this investment, because an extra 1 or 2% makes a huge difference between you know, what you're going to retire with in your bank account. So earlier in this interview, and also in one of your posts on your site, you talked about a concept of the magic number needed to retire. Can you elaborate on what you mean by the magic number? And did you specifically set that goal you thought you needed to hit in order to retire early?
Yeah, it's so the magic number pretty much is just that target number that you're aiming for to have in your investment portfolio, so that it'll be large enough to support your living expenses indefinitely. Now this is if you're investing in the stock market and bonds and like a portfolio. And, you know, people that do rental real estate or some other kind of income source, I mean, that's sort of separate from this, but so my magic number, I found a spreadsheet that I put together probably close to 10 years ago, very early on in my quest for financial independence, and I think I had $2.125 million in there, and that was a number that I had to have, and I guess that was probably accounting for inflation some, but it was a very large number, and I sort of backed into it from estimating what I thought I would want to spend each year. And this was, you know, like I said, very early in the process. As I kept working, and you know, we made more money, and we got better at cutting some living expenses. And then I started thinking about what will we actually spend money on. And hey, you know, this mortgage is going to be paid off soon. We have the ability to pay off the mortgage. So I started fine-tuning the plan and fine-tuning what we thought we would be spending in retirement down the road. You know, this was 3 or 4 years into it now. I'm thinking, what are we actually going to be spending? And so then I started developing a better idea of my magic number, what it would actually be. And so instead of 2.something million, I came up with like around 1.4 million. And that was really a lot closer to what we would actually need to be able to fund the lifestyle that we're actually living and that we enjoy living. And, you know, cover some other things like some college support for the kids. So you know, we start out with this really huge number and then fine-tuned it over time to come up with something that's more realistic, that would actually, it's more attainable for one thing, but also, you know, there's no point to work twice as long to save up twice as much money if you don't really need to.
Right. And so with the magic number, do you use the rule of 25? Or how would someone actually listening to this interview come up with their own magic number?
Yeah, so there's the 4% rule that's tossed about a lot. That's a pretty good rule to use for planning purposes, and I used that early on. The theory is that you can pull about 4% of your portfolio each year for 30 years, and you will never deplete your portfolio. At least that's true 95% of the time. So it's considered to be very safe. 95% of the time, if you pull 4% from your portfolio, you will not lose all of your money by the time that 30 years is up. And that's because long-term, your investments are going to grow, and that growth will offset a lot of the withdrawals each year. And so that's for 30 years. If you start looking at longer periods of early retirement or longer periods of being financially independent, in my case, you know, in my 30s, I'm planning for hopefully 5 or 6 decades, maybe more. And so you have to back off a little bit from that 4% rule, probably closer to 3.5%. I think I ended up coming up with like 3.25% for the 60 years that I'm thinking about. So you can spend about 3.25% of your portfolio. It's just a little bit lower number the longer you plan on living off your portfolio, or the earlier you retire, if you think of it that way. But that number is somewhere between 3 and 4% for pretty much. And so that number is what's considered to be safe based on, you know, 100 something years of market returns. And so, yeah, so you can, you know, if your number is 3%, it's essentially 1 divided by 0.03, which comes out to be 33 times your yearly expenses is what you need in your nest egg. If you use 4%, it's 1 divided by 0.04, or 25 times your annual expenses. So to come up with a number, your magic number, you know, think about if you're in your 50s or 60s and retiring and you want a 30-year time period, probably 4%. If you're in your 30s, probably 3%. Somewhere in between there, you know, a different number. But I'll go through it two ways to kind of throw the math behind it. But basically, if you have $1 million and you're spending 4% of it each year, that means you can live on $40,000 a year. If $40,000 a year is what you're comfortable with, and that's, you know, that covers all your expenses, then $1 million is your magic number. You know, if you want $80,000 a year, well then you're gonna have to have $2 million. 4% of $2 million is $80,000 a year. So it's sort of just you know, for planning purposes, you can back into it using that 4% rule. If you're using the 3% rule, like if you're in your 30s, you may want to use a 3% rule, 3.25%. $1 million will only generate $30,000 a year at 3%. So that number is less than the historical long-term returns of stocks.
Right.
Because you have volatility in the market. So when you retire that first year, the markets might be down a whole lot, and it may be down for the next couple of years. So you don't necessarily want to plan on getting a 7% or 9% return every year, because it just doesn't happen that way. You know, my own portfolio the last 2 years, I haven't had 9% returns the last 2 years. And that's why you draw much less than 9%, you know, that 3 or 4% number. But eventually the markets will turn around, and, you know, we'll all be having somewhere between 4 and 6 and 9% long-term growth over the next decade, few decades. But that's kind of how that magic number works. 4% is essentially the same as saying 25 times your annual expenses. That equals the nest egg that you need to be able to retire early on.
Perfect. So for someone who's, again, like you said, maybe in their 40s or 50s or 60s looking to retire, they basically take their annual expenses and multiply it by 25 to get their magic number. For someone like me who would want to retire early, I might have to increase that number to times 33 to get a safe withdrawal rate. Now, you talked about a return on your investment between, you mentioned a few different numbers, 6, 7, 8, 9%. So can you talk to me about where that number comes from and where you're getting those assumptions from that's going to be the return?
Yeah. Well, there's history. There's, you know, 100 and however many years of pretty good investment returns you can find online. I think Case Shiller maintains some investment data. I'm not sure of the index exactly, but there's data back to 1871 that's pretty good in terms of annual returns. And that's more of a historical, you know, what actually happened. And I don't have, you know, the number exactly, but I think it's like somewhere around 9% return. Included in that return is inflation. So if your inflation is around 3% and you have a 9% return, your real return after inflation is only about 6% per year, 9 minus 3%. So 6% per year is roughly the real return that we've seen over the last century or so. And then going forward, what's going to drive growth? Well, it's growth of earnings. Any kind of stock, they have earnings that you know, the companies that you own, they're making money, they're making profit. And it's that profit they're making each year and the growth of those earnings, that's what generates that long-term increase in stock value. So if a company is increasing their earnings at a let's say 5% rate each year, and they're also paying out a 2% dividend, then you would expect to see them go up in value about 7% per year. Well, that investment, you know, if you're reinvesting your dividends, they're growing at 5% a year and they're paying out 2% dividends. That's sort of how you get that long-term growth of 7% per year indefinitely. Now, the trick is that a company is only worth what people are willing to pay for it, and that's what the stock market is for. It's you know, people bid and ask. People bid on stocks all the time, every day, constantly. And so sometimes the price goes up, sometimes it goes down. So fundamentally, yeah, they might be growing the earnings at 5% a year over long term. But people may decide, gosh, you know, I'm really scared. I don't want to invest in stocks. They're really risky. And so the price gets bid down. And so you may grow earnings 5% in a year, but you may also, the stock may go down in price by 20% in a year. And so that's, you know, but those ups and downs in the market tend to average out over the long term. Over the short term, that's when people panic and, you know, sell, and the values get really low, and then you buy, and then you make money that way if you're buying at a low point. But that's kind of, just to get back to your question, that 7% long-term return, it's really just growth in the underlying economy that drives profit growth in companies that you're owning through the stock market.
Okay, so we'll get into asset allocation in just a second because I like to hear more about what you just talked about. But one point before we move on, I just want to clarify is, so with the safe withdrawal rate, you're not really ever drawing against the principal. That's always just there. You're drawing against your earnings on that principal.
The idea is yes, your principal is growing so much that you're essentially spending that growth in the principal. But you know, if the stock market does really bad over 30 years, you may actually be eating into your principal some, and that's okay. I mean, that's part of that safety aspect of it. The safe, you know, the 4% being a safe withdrawal rate. By depleting that principal, you are surviving in terms of paying your annual living expenses. But it doesn't mean that you're necessarily keeping all of your principal intact. And that's kind of where reducing that withdrawal rate for longer term,
right,
early retirements is the key, because you know, you don't want to spend 4% a year and deplete it in year 30 if you're planning on 30 more years after that. So, but just decreasing it a little bit helps in terms of making it last a whole lot longer, because just because of the kind of the way that the long-term returns work, numerically or statistically speaking, if you look at a whole bunch of different 30-year periods, and there are calculators out there, and I'll throw one out. It's called CFIRESIM, S-I-M. There's another one called FIRECALC, and those look at these historical scenarios from back in the 1870s forward. It looks at 30-year periods and how you would have done if you're pulling out 4% each year, and, you know, did your portfolio up? Did it go down? How did it work out? And that's where, if you look at a whole bunch of those 30-year periods, only 5% of them failed if you pull out about 4% per year. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's you may be spending on principal, but you may also, you know, you may have one of those scenarios where you're seeing 7% growth throughout most of the time period, and you're only spending 4% of it. So you might end up with double what you started with, potentially.
Okay, so those calculators were CFIRESIM and FIRECAL?
FIRECALC, FIRECALC.
Perfect. Okay, so that's a really great reference point to kind of simulate what would happen if you lived in a past time. So obviously, to get to the point where you retired early, I think you had a number of 1.3 or 1.4 million or in between that. You had to save a lot. So let's talk a little bit about saving rate and how that kind of impacts the rate at which you're going to retire. So my first question is, what was your average saving rate between you and your wife over that 10-year period?
Yeah, probably between 50 to 70%, pretty much every year, very consistently. And we, you know, as we made more money, we essentially banked raises, didn't spend all the raises or didn't spend all the bonuses. So we kind of kept our lifestyle consistent, other than having a couple extra kids. But we kind of kept our spending the same. We kept the same cars. We kept the same house. We didn't upgrade our lifestyle as we upgraded our incomes. So by the end of it, we were able to save more percentage-wise, much more than we were when we started out. So probably about 70% at the end we're saving.
So I've been doing these interviews for a little while now, and when I talk to people that I know in my day-to-day life about these stories of people retiring early, I usually get one of two reactions. One, that's amazing, how can I do that? And two, kind of followed up with a little bit of hesitation and wondering, you know, putting away 50 to 70% of your income, that's a much, much greater rate than the average person saves. And so a lot of people's responses, maybe they're scared or kind of in denial, but the question is, did they have fun and enjoy their life during that period, or was it just all about saving? So can you address that point with how saving that much changed your lifestyle, and would you do anything differently?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess you got to think about, it's all relative. I mean, if like we topped out around $140,000 per year combined incomes, and we were saving about 70% of that. So imagine if someone was making double that. So they're making maybe $280,000 a year in their household. And that's, you know, not atypical if you're living in a high cost living area, or, you know, you have a software job, or you're a professional, a lawyer, a doctor, or whatever. But anyway, just consider a person that's making twice what we are. Could they not save the same thing that we're saving just as easily? It's sort of like, you know, you got to divorce the amount that you spend from how much you make, because, you know, we enjoy a lifestyle that's, I mean, I would describe as comfortably middle class. We have a four-bedroom house and two cars that are old but well-maintained, two Hondas. You know, looking around right now, I'm looking out at the lake we live on, and we have high-definition TVs, and I'm, you know, I've got a laptop, two laptops sitting here, and video game systems. And so, I mean, we don't, you know, we don't live in an ultra-frugal lifestyle by any means. Probably the biggest difference between our lifestyle and the people that are earning $140,000 per year and spend every penny of it, they probably live in a bigger house, probably a nicer neighborhood. We live in, I think our house is like 75% of the median house value here in Raleigh, North Carolina. But it's, you know, it's a big yard, nice house, decent area. The cars are older. You know, we have 15-year-old Hondas. Other people are probably driving 5 to 7-year-old cars or even newer at our income levels before I retired. So other than that, I mean, the only difference, we didn't go out to eat that much. We cook all the time at home, but, you know, we're pretty good at it, and cooking more often, you get better at it. So we do save a lot on restaurants. And, I mean, we go on international trips just about every year now. There was a period where when the kids were really young, it just wasn't that much fun to haul a 1-year-old or a baby around on an airplane a lot. So we sort of held off on vacations for a while. But, you know, the last several years, we've been on one or more international vacations each year. You know, we do it on the cheap. We, you know, we figure out how to work airline points and hotel deals and do rental VRBO or Airbnb rentals when we travel. So, I mean, we're not paying a ton of money, but we're, you know, staying in pretty decent places and able to fly on regular airplanes just like everyone else. So, I mean, in a way, yeah, we've sacrificed by not buying the absolute biggest house possible, but we have, you know, more than enough in just about every aspect of life. I mean, from some people's point of view, we would certainly be sacrificing compared to what we could consume, but I guess that was never really our goal, was to have the largest house possible in town, just because we would be working until we're 70 if that was really the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just said at the end, working until you're 70, if that was the goal, I don't think a lot of people realize how closely your saving rate is correlated with the speed at which you'll retire. I mean, if you have a saving rate of 50%, you could retire in 15 or 17 years. If you have a saving rate, and I think this is the average saving rate of 5 or 10%, it might mean that you're working 50 plus years, right? So you kind of have to look at that and make the decisions from there.
Yeah, and it's and saving more is kind of helps you reach financial independence earlier by two ways. One is that you're obviously saving a lot more money, so you have more money invested, and it's invested for longer terms, and you know you're building up a bigger nest egg. But the second way is by saving all that money, you're spending less money. And when you spend less money, you don't need as much money in your investment accounts to support yourself. So we have spent somewhere, you know, $25,000 to $35,000 a year, plus mortgage payments when we had them. So, you know, let's say $30,000 a year. If we're spending $30,000 per year, we need that 1-point-something million. If we're spending $60,000 or $80,000 a year, you know, we're probably talking about needing more like $2 million. So just that difference in spending between $30,000 and $60,000 means we need about an extra $1 million if we're pulling out at a 3% withdrawal rate. So that kind of illustrates, you know, if you can cut spending, you can really cut that amount of money that you need to save up to be able to reach financial independence.
Yeah, so you can save more or you can earn more and be able to spend a bit more and still maintain a high saving rate. So I think for listeners, they need to kind of look at what position they're in. Do they have an immediate ability to kind of increase their earnings? And if so, great, maybe that will factor into their decision-making process, or maybe looking at their spending is going to be the fastest way to kind of increase the rate at which they're going to retire. At least that's how I look at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just before we move on, one thing you touched on was using credit card points to travel. For the listeners on this call, we did a great interview with Scott Grimer from MileValue.com, and he talks all about traveling with credit card points. So you might want to check that out because that's a really creative way to still enjoy traveling while reducing your overall spending. I booked a flight for free using those methods, and they're very, very practical pieces of advice. So moving on to the next part of the interview, I'm really excited about this particular topic, and that's asset allocation. So this is a part that I think typically overwhelms a lot of people of, you know, what do I actually, now that I have these savings, what do I actually do with them? So how did you determine your asset allocation strategy, and what asset allocation, excuse me, would you suggest to someone just starting out with investing?
Okay, sure. Well, I guess my asset allocation strategy is, I would say, advanced, a little bit complicated, but it works for me and I understand it. So I'll go over what I do, and then I'll go over what I would recommend other, what I actually do recommend other people to do all the time when they ask me, how do you invest? So my portfolio, I have it split up into, I believe, 10 different asset classes. So it's kind of a, you might call it a slice and dice asset allocation model. I believe it's based on something that Paul Merriman came up with a long time ago, but I was just searching around the internet, again, probably 8-9 years ago when I was first kind of figuring out this whole financial independence thing and how to invest on my own, and just looking at how to invest, and I was reading about there's a premium for small cap stocks, there's a premium for value stocks, meaning companies that are selling with a low price to book value, essentially boring stocks. When you think of growth stocks, that's like the Apples and the Googles, the companies that are growing a whole lot and coming out with these new tech products, and you know, they grow a whole lot, and that's why they go up in value, is because people are willing to buy them because they're growing. The value stocks are kind of the boring ones, like they manufacture things like bricks or tennis shoes or carpet, commodity goods a lot of times, just kind of boring stuff that like you never hear about in the news, and you make products but you don't really, you're not necessarily excited about them, and it's nothing really innovative. They're just, they generate profit by, you know, these companies sell stuff. So anyway, I have a tilt towards value stocks and small cap stocks. I have an international allocation separately, and the same sort of small cap and value asset classes within the international area. There's an emerging markets allocation I have. About 5% of my portfolio is in emerging markets. And it's an index fund, and I'll touch on index funds in a second. But and then in the U.S. allocation and the international allocation, I have real estate investment trusts. There are index funds for those too. So I've kind of got the money split out in about 10 different pots of money, and I have fixed percentages for each asset class that I want to stick with. And as those asset classes go up and down in value, and they typically don't move all together. I mean, I think last year real estate investments went up like crazy, and the rest of the market was kind of flat to slightly up, and international stuff was like way down, or down some. So my portfolio did okay because of these real estate investments that I had. This year I haven't looked at it that closely. I don't really pay that much attention to it. It just kind of just grows in the background. But this year is going to be different. It's probably not going to be real estate. It's probably something else, large caps or something that's done really well. I don't know. But I just rebalanced, actually, and so I ended up, I believe I sold some large cap stocks, I sold some real estate, and I had to buy some more international and some more emerging markets to get my portfolio back to those target percentages that I want to own. And the good part about this is I'm selling those asset classes that have gone up in value, and I'm buying those asset classes that have gone down in value. So I'm sort of, just by using these rules of rebalancing my portfolio, I'm hitting the goal of selling high and buying low. But it also keeps my portfolio in balance so that I'm not too overbalanced in these riskier asset classes like emerging markets and small cap stocks and that sort of thing. So that's kind of how I run my portfolio, and it's a little bit complicated, so I would not recommend it for anyone who doesn't understand it right now. It's not the way to get started if you're new to investing. It's probably intimidating and confusing. So just ignore the last couple of minutes of this conversation if that's the case for you. What most people should start out with is very simple. There are one-stop shop investments you can actually buy, and I want to mention some Vanguard investments that I particularly like that may be appropriate for everyone.
Okay.
They have a series of Life Strategy. They're called Life Strategy Growth Fund, Conservative Growth, Moderate Growth. Those just are, some of them are more risky, some are less risky. but they kind of mix up the stocks and the bonds and the international stocks that you want in a portfolio, and it's all in one fund. Those are good single funds if you want to own just one fund. Vanguard has phenomenally good index funds as well, and those index funds tend to have very, very low expenses, very low turnover within the fund themselves, which means you're not going to be paying a lot of fees internally within that fund, and they basically just, you're paying 0.0% per year for most of them to have Vanguard manage your money within these ETFs or these mutual funds. But Vanguard also has like the total U.S. market index fund, the total international index fund, and then the total bond market index fund. So you kind of have a three-fund portfolio. And they have a good asset allocation tool at their website. You can probably Google Vanguard Investor Questionnaire, and it'll pull up a link to it'll ask you questions about your own risk, willingness to take on risk, and what's appropriate for you based on your time horizon, that sort of thing. How long do you plan on saving for? How long do you want to be retired for? And it'll actually give you a recommendation, based on their research, give you a recommendation on those three funds that they have, the total U.S., total international, and total bond market. It'll give you a recommendation on what your ideal portfolio will look like. So I usually will recommend that to people to say, hey, if you want to manage your own portfolio and you want to do it as cheaply as possible, those three funds are kind of the cornerstones of a good portfolio. And then from there, if you want to build out and add some, add a little slice of real estate in there, or if you want to add commodities in there, or if you want to add a small cap fund or something, or emerging markets, something more risky, do that to complement the core of the portfolio. But the core should be that U.S. market, international market, bond market. Those are kind of the three cornerstones. I don't really have any bonds in my portfolio to speak of, but for a lot of people, those are appropriate if you don't want to take on a lot of volatility.
Okay, great. So as you mentioned, your strategy is a little more complex, but basically it's comprised of a number of different asset classes. And so before we move on, I want to talk about the asset classes for just a second. What is the reason that you have so many? Is it because, as you mentioned, they don't move together, so it's making a more defendable portfolio if there's a crash in the U.S. market? That doesn't necessarily mean the international market's down and vice versa.
Yeah, it's part of, I guess you'd say, modern portfolio theory. The research is, if you buy a bunch of different asset classes that are not correlated strongly together, over time, some will go up, some will go down, but overall it will smooth out your fluctuations in your portfolio value. So you can still buy risky asset classes, but because they don't move in a one-to-one correlation with each other, they will kind of rebalance themselves or kind of balance out the risk, where 1 year U.S. market may be up a lot and the international is down. The next year it may be the opposite. But when you look at an average of all the, in my case, the 10 different asset classes I own, it keeps the returns more moderate. It moderates the returns, but also moderates that risk. It keeps the fluctuations lower too.
Okay. And so earlier you were talking about the cost of an investment and how if the cost is 1-2% when someone's managing your money, that really digs into your overall return in the long term. So Vanguard ETFs, that's your suggestion for, in a sense, a managed group of stocks or bonds in this case, but at a much lower cost.
Their expense ratios are, I think their total U.S. market or S&P 500 ETF, they're around 0.05% expense ratio. So, compare 1-2% in maybe a typical actively managed mutual fund, or going with an advisor that charges 1-2%. Comparing 1% versus 0.05%, that one is 20 times more expensive than the other one, and you may not really get much more out of that 20 times more expensive person or service. So yeah, the Vanguard, I mean, and there are other providers. Schwab has some, iShares have some good ETFs. But really it's just understanding and looking at that expense ratio to figure out how much are you actually paying for the management of your investments in that ETF or that mutual fund. But that the expense ratio is very important. The other key thing is turnover ratio, because that's a number that measures how frequently they're buying or selling stocks within that portfolio.
And so earlier you talked about return on your initial investment of 6%, 7%, 8% in the fullness of time. And following the strategy, let's say someone goes to Vanguard, they get a few ETFs in the total U.S. market, total international, and total bond. That's a pretty good starting point to look for those investment returns that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So that's good to know. All right, so that's a really good starting point for the asset allocation. The next topic that's important to talk about is shrinking your paycheck. And I'm excited about this because if you're able to take more money home after tax, you have more money to put into your investments. So on your blog, you speak about the concept of shrinking your paycheck. And the concept you outline is do everything you can to make your take-home pay as small as possible. Can you explain this methodology and how it works in practice?
Yeah, basically, you know, for a lot of middle-class people, upper-middle-class people, your paycheck, it gets bigger and bigger as you advance in the workforce. But a lot of times you don't see a whole lot more in take-home pay because all that extra income means you're getting pushed into a higher tax bracket. You're paying more and more taxes. And so the whole goal, if you really want to save hardcore, and one way to do that is to save a whole lot on taxes. This is something that we were able to pay almost zero federal taxes, federal income tax, by shrinking the paycheck. So we would max out all of our retirement accounts, 401ks. I was a state employee for a while, and so I had access to a 457. You can actually contribute the maximum $18,000 per year to that. On top of the $18,000, you can put into your 401k. You can max both of them out if you're a state employee and you have access to a 457. So we would intentionally shrink our paycheck by maxing out all these different retirement accounts. We would contribute to a health savings account when we had access to it. Any kind of money you can pull out of that, of what's being taxed, it's going to save you, in our case, tens of thousands on taxes. And that means that you can save those tens of thousands of dollars. You can save that into your own investment portfolio. It's your money once again. It's not the government's money. So in my example at my state job, I was making close to $70,000 per year, but I had, $36,000, $38,000 taken out for my 401k and my 457. I had another, I think 6% taken out for my pension contributions that I cashed out when I left because I didn't qualify for a pension. So 6% of $70,000, so another $4,000 roughly, for that. And so I was basically taking over $40,000 per year out of my $70,000 salary and deferring that from taxes between the 457, 401k, and the pension plan. So it looked like I was only making less than $30,000 per year come tax time. And, I mean, my paycheck got so low it was about $800 every 2 weeks. And so it's kind of a joke in a way because it was, you know, almost nothing. I mean, that's still a minimum wage paycheck, but I shrunk it by more than half, and which means that I'm not paying any federal income tax on that $40,000 that I put into those savings accounts. And so that's kind of the essence of it, is getting yourself down into a lower tax bracket. We ended up, I believe, in the 15% tax bracket most of our working years, and just we never really paid. Some years we would pay a few thousand dollars. Then we had kids, and that kind of took care of our most of our tax liability. But it's something. I mean, you can do with and without kids. I mean, kids save more on taxes, but it's not a requirement by any means. So definitely explore any kind of tax saving option that you have, and don't rule out the tax benefits from it. And we actually saved so much and reduced our income enough to where we were making a low enough income to contribute to deductible traditional IRAs as well, which led to another $10,000 or $11,000 reduction in our incomes and lowered our taxes even more. So it's really just, you know, maxing out those accounts where you can, saving all that money on taxes, and then, you know, we've probably saved $100,000 in taxes over the years and let that money grow. So that's, you know, that's part of the money that we have in our investments is money that we've saved on taxes.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. So, okay, so shrinking your paycheck, that's a really important concept. Putting money into accounts like your 401k, your IRAs. You mentioned that you worked with the state for a while. So you had, what was it, 457?
457 account, yeah.
457. And then what are some other examples of ways listeners can shrink their paycheck, contributing their health accounts?
Yeah, health savings account, HSA, or flexible spending account, FSA. You can do an FSA if you have child care expenses. There's a child care FSA. If you have any kind of like a cafeteria plan that lets you save for commuting or other kinds of child care options, those are sometimes possible ways to lower your paycheck. We did that with child care, actually, the FSA. We used that for child care. The big ones are the 401k, 457, or 403b, if certain kinds of government employees have that. For the feds, they have the thrift saving plan, the TSP. That's another great option there. Explore any kind of ways you can shrink your paycheck, and it will certainly pay off big time when you do your taxes.
Yep, so max those out first, if possible, when it comes to filling up your investment account, because that will help shrink your paycheck.
Yep.
Okay, great. So that was another piece of really good advice. So we're getting close to the end of our interview, and I think it would be helpful if we could just recap some of the steps that we've talked about. So could you walk me through the high-level steps from starting at identifying your magic number through to, you know, saving and creating an investment plan our listeners need to do in order to become financially independent?
Okay. So, yeah, I guess just to start at the very beginning, you know, if you're just starting out in life, wherever you are, save, cut your expenses and save what you can. But don't forget to have some fun along the way. I mean, don't save absolutely everything, because you're going to get burnt out after a year and not be able to save much at all if you go crazy. So, save a lot. That's a big part of it. Figure out the investments. Invest in low cost. I like index funds, low cost index funds. Great way to capture that long-term return from the growth of stocks over a decade or two decades or three decades. Save consistently, so even when the markets are down and the stock market is really, really bad and all your friends are saying how horrible it is and you know, you'd be stupid to invest in it, yeah, keep investing in it. Keep doing it anyway. We did really well back in 08, 09 when it was down very, very low, and it's some of the stuff has more than doubled just in 5 or 6 years. So definitely keep saving consistently over time. To come up with your own number that you need for financial independence, you know, somewhere between 25 to 33 times your annual expenses is what you'll need. When you think about your annual expenses in retirement, you may be able to take out some things like how much it costs you to commute to work, if you have to buy a wardrobe for work, lunches out at work, having a nice new car if you're driving clients around somewhere. Those expenses will go away or shrink once you do retire. You'll also be paying less taxes in retirement, most likely. Most people do, because you won't have all the payroll taxes and you won't have to earn as much, a large of a paycheck, because you don't have to save for yourself anymore. So your taxes will probably go down as well. But take whatever you're going to end up spending in your ideal retirement and be realistic about it, you know. But then take that times 25 to 33, and that'll give you your kind of your number, your own number for yourself. And then, you know, there's online calculators to figure out if you have a 7% growth per year and you're putting in X thousand dollars per year, how long will it take you to retire? If you're, you know, it might be 15 years or it might be 30 years until your annual savings and what you already have, that grows to the point where you have enough, that where you reach that magic number. And you know, you can fine-tune the plan as you go along. You may realize that I love scuba diving, and I want to do 4 scuba dive trips per year, and that's going to cost an extra $6,000 per year. Well, you know, if you're willing to pay for it, put it in your budget, increase your number if that's what's required, recalculate, and then, you know, you have your new number. But I think the key thing is just saving a lot, finding low-cost investments, identifying what you actually think you might spend, coming up with that magic number from it, and then just, you know, keep saving and investing, and don't blow it in a midlife crisis.
Awesome. All right. Well, for everyone who's listening who would like to learn more from Justin, definitely check out his blog, rootofgood.com. It's a great resource for becoming financially independent and just learning more about his approach to it, which I thought was really great. His posts are all really well written and very clear and easy to follow, which always helps. So, Justin, thank you so much for being here. Is there anything else you want to add or final thought you want to leave our listeners with before we sign off?
I mean, I've pretty much covered everything I can think of, but I mean, just wanted to reiterate, you know, it's your life, so make the most of it. And I think there's a lot of kind of small tweaks you can do with your own spending, your own, you know, the way you think about wealth, to make it so that you can save a little bit more and eventually reach financial independence. I mean, lots of people that are listening probably might not be in their 20s or 30s, so they might be looking at, you know, a later retirement than in retiring in their 30s, but that's okay. But the key thing is thinking about wherever you are now, how can you improve your situation now so that you set yourself up to be where you want to be 5 years out or 10 years out, 20 years out, however long it takes. So I guess just think about that. Make sure, you know, you're intentionally making those choices in life that gets you where you want to be.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. All right. Well, Justin, thank you so much. This has been great. There's been a lot of really good information in this interview. So once again, thank you for being here. And for all of the listeners, definitely visit rootofgood.com.
All right. Thanks a lot.